I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The doors of the Iraqi Museum in Baghdad are still closed to the public. Museum officials barred those doors prior to the American invasion a year and a half ago. They were forced open by looters in the days after the fall of Saddam Hussein. And while the theft and the destruction were less drastic than initially reported, much was stolen and many pieces badly damaged. The Iraqi National Museum remains closed today. It's just not safe enough outside to open. And today we're happy to welcome the Director General of Iraq's museums back to The Connection. Donnie George and his staff are at the museum every day, still retrieving lost items, rebuilding and recataloging the collection. Mr. George is in Boston for a meeting with the Archaeological Institute of America, and he's going to bring us up to date on what's known about the many treasures of Mesopotamia that are still missing or at risk, as well as share some thoughts on what life is like on the streets of Baghdad these days. We'd like to have you join our conversation. For example, how important is it to preserve a country's cultural history when the people there aren't even safe on the streets? And what questions do you have about life in Baghdad and the perspectives of Iraqis these days? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I should tell you that there are a number of links on our website, theconnection.org, where you can see photos of items that are still missing, some of the artifacts that have been recovered for the Baghdad museums. And as I mentioned earlier, Donnie George is Director General of Iraq's museums. He's here in our Connection studio. It's nice to have you back.
Thank you.
Let's review where you are in rebuilding and recataloging the Connection. As I mentioned in opening the program, those early reports of 170,000 artifacts were exaggerated. Nobody knew at the time what was missing and what wasn't. In fact, if I recall correctly, there was a long period of time when that question hung in the air because the museum itself was just not a safe place to go and look for things, right?
That's right, yes. And as you said, that 170,000 items, it was a mistake. You know, somebody asked me, what's the volume of the material in the Iraq Museum? And I said, we have over 170,000 objects. And it was immediately taken that 170,000 items are missing from them. And that was not true. But now we know, at least even the estimation is not finished, we know that 15,000 items are missing from the Iraq Museum.
When you talk about items missing, how big, how small, how valuable, how well do you know now what's missing?
Yeah, we know these 15,000 by numbers, of course, and they range from a one-inch cylinder seal or tiny little beads to a half-size statue of a king. You see, made of stone and other things made of pottery and ivory and even gold and silver material. Yeah.
And you're able to use the internet in a way that I understand has been quite helpful in helping track some of these items. I mentioned again at the beginning of the program that there are websites. The State Department maintains one. The University of Chicago's Oriental Institute has a website. UNESCO has another one.
That's right.
And you run your own, do you not, as well?
We are preparing our website. It's called The Iraq Museum, and that's it. And actually, it's on trial now in a special address so scholars can go and check everything. Then it will be open for everybody. And we will have, of course, a lot of information on that, too. Yeah.
A lot of stuff has been taken from Iraq over the centuries. I mean, the steel of Hammurabi still sits in the Louvre in France, and yeah. I know that there are other pieces yeah. that you'd dearly love to have back. But it seems to me, and I'm quite interested to know your perspective, that there's been something of a shift here, that something about the attack on the museum touched a lot of people, and a lot of material that you thought might have never returned is in fact being brought back, not necessarily by border guards in Jordan, but even by ordinary Iraqis.
That's right. A lot of people are working on this, helping us. Friends all over the world are working on this. Inside the country, we have the Iraqi police, the Iraqi customs, the multinational forces are working on this. And the Iraqi people themselves turn material back to the museum. Among them are some of the parties that are using their members to collect material and bring it back to the museum. There are a lot of people who buy these things from the looters and bring them back to the museum, Iraqi people, and they don't ask for their money. So
they pay their own money to buy them from the looters and then just donate them back to the
museum.
Exactly.
And by this, I can give you some numbers. For instance, 3,323 pieces are back to the museum. All have the IM numbers on them. And we have 1,450 pieces that don't have numbers. We believe they come from looters that have dug into the archaeological sites in the country. Not only that, these are back to the museum itself. But outside Iraq, we have information that 38 pieces are in Kuwait, 18 are in Saudi Arabia, 1,250 in Jordan, 360 in Syria. We don't know what's there in Turkey and in Iran, but there are 300 pieces in Italy, and over 600 pieces are captured here in the United States.
Now, what are you asking all those different countries to do, Mr. George? Are you saying hold on to them until things are a little bit more secure? Do you think it's time now to bring them back?
No, it's exactly this way. We just ask them to keep them until everything is safe enough so we'll get them back.
Give me an example, if you can, of something that was well known or precious to you that was brought back that you thought might never return.
Well, there are several examples of this. One of them is the Warka vase. That's a huge vase. It's about 1 meter, 20 centimeters. It comes from
ceramic vase, is it?
No, it's a stone alabaster vase. It was found in Warka, Uruk Warka city, famous Sumerian city. It goes back to 3,200 years B.C. And it is actually, it explains the philosophy of the Sumerians about the universe and the creation of man and animal and on earth, because it starts giving pictures of water, then plants, then animal, then man who is serving the gods who are on top of the vase. So
it was taken during the looting, was it?
Yes, it was taken away, and it's back to the museum. It's in our laboratories. We are working on it.
Any idea what happened to it?
Well, this particular piece was taken by somebody, an Iraqi, who actually one day came to me after the war, and he said that there was a guy, I don't know. He said, I have some items, I want to bring them back to the museum. And by that day, I was leaving to London. 2 months later, he came and he brought the material. And I thought he was bringing it back to the museum while I was in London, but no, he said he would bring it to me personally. So he really brought it back to the museum himself.
With any story behind it, with any explanation, like I took it because I thought that I had the opportunity, I might make some money, and I've changed my mind, or no story about it?
I don't understand. I did not understand this guy, you see. But sorry. But there is another guy. There was two cousins, actually. They came to us after the war and said that they have some objects. And they were at the museum. And they felt very sad of what was happening to the museum. And they said, we have objects from the museum. And we will bring them back as soon as we see that the museum is safe enough. Mm. So after a few days, when we had the American tanks surrounded the museum and guards, there were some people said that, Donnie, there are people bringing objects to the museum, and they were the same guys. And they really brought precious material. One of them was the statue of King Shalmaneser III, the Assyrian king. And they brought 9 very important objects that they had taken from the galleries of the museum.
You remind me of another piece that you told me about once, the Sumerian king. Antamena, is that how you say his name?
Anatum, yes.
Now, that was a piece that was taken. Is it back yet?
No, not yet, unfortunately.
What does it look like?
It's a black steatite statue, half size, headless.
It's half size, that means it's what, 4 or 5 feet tall? This is a...
No, half natural size, I would say, yeah. It is a black statue, headless. It is naked from the belt and up, and it has a skirt made of wool. It looks like wool, And that's it. And it has a cuneiform inscription on the back of the right shoulder. It's mentioning the name of the king, Eannatum.
Do you think somebody could still sell that? I mean, I know that there is this vast black market for stolen items, but because of the profile that some of these items have, would that be a difficult one for someone to try and sell, even privately?
I'm sure it will be a difficult thing to sell it or even to take it out of Iraq. But I believe it's still in Iraq, but we have to look for it.
You're not thinking that everything that was going to come back has come back. You think that there's more in the country that will still be returned?
Yes, we believe that. And there are very, very good joint forces looking for everything. Iraqi police, Iraqi customs, even the multinational forces there, the American forces are doing just fine in some cases, yeah.
And if you were to go for a walk in the market, would you see something for sale there, or are people a little bit...
No, it's not in the market. It's a secret market, you see. I believe it's done by connections here and there. Yeah.
My guest is Donnie George. He is Director General of Iraq's Museums. He's in Boston for a meeting with the Archaeological Institute of America. He's taking some time out of his schedule to join us and talk about what's going on in the museum system. When we come back after the break, we'll talk about those remote archaeological sites, the ones that are particularly difficult to try and secure. We'll also talk a little bit more about what it's like to live in Baghdad today. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour is Donnie George. He is Director General of Iraq's Museums, considered by his peers to be one of the most knowledgeable about what has been found and what has yet to be found in the sands of Mesopotamia. And if you're interested in seeing a little bit more about the artifacts that were stolen and have been recovered and the arts and the pieces that are still missing, you can go to our website at theconnection.org. We have a number of links to different museums and agencies that are trying to help out. We said at the beginning of the program, Donnie, that the museum is not open yet. Is that your decision to keep it closed?
Well, yes, according to the situation, the security situation, it is our decision. It's not only closed. I have sealed the storerooms by welding. Now, several doors to the stores. So completely the stores are sealed. Nobody could go there.
The National Library, the building that was burned in the initial invasion of Baghdad, that has reopened, has it not?
They have found a new building for them,
right?
And they are starting to open. Yes.
I just wonder if you can be a little more specific. What is it that you're waiting for? What will help you change your mind? Say yes, no, maybe it's time to open the door.
It's the security situation, and there's something else. The museum, unfortunately, is very close to Haifa Street, where there are a lot of operations there. Almost every day we have actions there. You see, insurgents and American forces are there. Several times I myself had witnessed on top of the Iraq Museum, helicopter gunships are shooting. Down to Haifa Street. So, and we had shooting on our guards and from these insurgents. So I believe it's a kind of testing whether these guards are there, are ready to defend the museum or not. I always ask the guards to shoot back fiercely so that they know that this place is guarded well. You see, so we are having actual direct threats to the museum.
These are not normal things that museum directors are supposed to deal with.
Well, yes, of course, they are not normal, but we have our antiquities to defend, and we defend them by our lives. You know.
I'm wondering how it is that you go to work in the morning. You have to drive across the city to get to the museum. There must be many days when you choose not to go.
I choose to go every day, but I tell you one thing. Every single day when I start from home, I pray a small prayer, I cross my hand, and I start from home, and I don't know whether I will make it to the museum or not. The same thing I do when I go back from the museum, I go back home. And this is a daily thing because accidents are happening all over the time in the streets. People responsible, director generals, are subject to be assassinated any time, you see. So for twice, my driver was threatened and was shot, but happily he was not injured. So they wanted to get his car or I don't know. So I'm going, I have a driver and a car. Now I'm going with my car. Sometimes I switch cars with my son. Sometimes I leave my car. I get a taxi. Sometimes I go the right way, this way, or the other day I go the second day. Sometimes I start at 7:30 in the morning. Sometimes I start at 9 o'clock in the morning. So I change time, change my route every day, but I have to go to the museum.
Would it make any difference to say to the Prime Minister or one of his people, I'd like some security people with me, I'd like to have some guards traveling with me, or would that just draw attention to yourself?
Well, that will draw much more attention, you see. We do have guards. We can use our guards from the museum, but we don't want to do that because then we will be 100% targeted. So we just mix ourselves with the people in the street, and that's it.
Are you a target because you have a high profile within society? Or are you a target because people say, right, he runs the museums, he works with the interim government works with the Americans, therefore Donny George is a collaborator with the Americans. I don't know what the mentality is.
Yeah, it is something like that, yes. They are actually targeting the people who are working with the government. And exactly as you said, so once the government is working with the Americans, so everybody is actually working with the Americans. But it's not that way. You know, we are government staff, and we are working for the country, whether the Americans were there or not, you see. They are helping us, yes, this is true, but we are Iraqis working for our government, working for our museum. But these are just excuses to destabilize the life in Baghdad, especially in Baghdad. Yeah.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Donny George is Director General of Iraq's Museums. We're talking about his work and also getting to work, life in Baghdad today. Your chance to join our conversation. We're going to Charleston, South Carolina, and Catherine's calling. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
I first wanted to tell Director George thank you for all you do. As an archaeologist and a heritage professional here in Charleston, South Carolina, I was really devastated when I heard the news about the looting. One of the questions, Dick, that you asked early on in the program was, is the protection of the cultural heritage in a particular place a priority when a disaster strikes? And I think that obviously we've seen that in Iraq for the last several years, and we've seen it really now with the tsunami in the countries that has affected. And I guess my comment really is just that one day all will be calm in a lot of these places. And until then, I think what Director George and a lot of heritage professionals have to do in these situations is safeguard the collections. And with heritage sites, people really need the familiar. They need the markers that inform them about their culture and give pride in their culture and identity. And so the preservation of not only artifacts but also heritage sites is so important, and especially in time like this. And even sometimes when people say, oh, well, you know, this isn't a priority right now, we have to deal with the human toll, the protection of the sites and the artifacts has to be a pressing issue along with the human cost. So even now with the tsunami, with the human toll, people are going in and assessing damage to heritage sites in those countries, and that's appropriate.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Catherine. This is a very, very nice remark you mentioned. Yes, our people are threatened all the time, but we have to do our best to protect the cultural heritage, whether they were artifacts all the archaeological sites. And now we have, for the first time in Iraq, we have a special force for the antiquity. We call them FPS, Police of Antiquities.
And they have actually started. We have recruited until now 1,750 policemen with cars and with weapons and communication systems. And actually, 2 weeks ago, they had their first catch. They caught four looters with artifacts, and they are working very good in the southern parts of the country. So although these danger events are all over, but we are not forgetting the cultural heritage of the country.
What happens when these people are caught? Are they put in jail? Are they tried? What will happen?
Yeah, they are put in jail. We have, according to the antiquities law, they have to go into jail. Yeah.
No, I'm not saying sure. It's not the right place for them.
Then, of course, we have courts. They are sent to courts, and that's it. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about what's happening at the remote sites, because I remember when we last spoke a year ago, this was something that was causing you some considerable despair, that there was no way of safeguarding those sites, which were, I mean, they're difficult to get to back in the days of Saddam Hussein. They're that which I guess makes them that much harder to try and protect.
That's right, yes. And as I mentioned, we always dreamt to have our own police to protect these sites. We did have guards, you know, local guards protecting these sites, but what would one guard or two do for 100 or 200 people coming and armed people and digging? But,
is that what they were facing? Like
yes.
Great
yes,
groups
yes.
of people coming together.
Exactly. But now, as I said, we have started recruiting police. We call them archaeological police. They are FPS, this Facilities Protection Police. But they are special. They are connected with us, with the State Board of Antiquities and Ministry of Culture. We pay them. And we are seeking cars and communication systems for them. They are actually patrolling now in the southern parts of the country. And not only that, as I said, they have captured. We are now trying to recruit some young archaeologists who we don't have vacancies for them now in the department, but we'll try to recruit them as officers for these FPS police for antiquities. So we will have archaeologists who are officers in this this task force, if we may call it, protecting the archaeological sites. So we are moving to have, we hope, some kind of complete protection of these sites.
My guest is Donnie George. He is Director General of the Iraq Museums. He's here for a few brief days in the United States talking to different agencies and museums about getting some help, some assistance to continue the cataloging. I should just remind our listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. If you'd like to join us. Donnie, I made a couple of scribbles from today's news. 18 young workers, bodies found near Mosul. They'd been shot some time ago. 9 U.S. soldiers killed. The police chief of Sadr City assassinated in his car. Earlier this week, car bombs in Bakuba, in Hilla. The death toll for this week alone in Iraq is 90 people. And it's hard, I think, for people here to imagine that the city of Baghdad can even function under circumstances like that. I mean, you mentioned your son. Is he working? Does he stay at home? Can you go to the market? Are the universities open? It's kind of difficult when these are the facts that we get about Iraq to imagine what goes on in that country.
Well, I tell you one thing. You cannot imagine if you walk in the streets of Baghdad, you will never witness what you have mentioned.
But this is, I'm not making this stuff up.
No, you are not, of course. These are the real news, yes. But normal life is in Baghdad. It's there. Millions of students are back to the to school. Universities are working. My son is in his last year doing computer science in the university. My daughter is in her second year in medical school. My younger son, Martin, is in high school. They are going to school and college, but we are so much concerned. We follow them in the morning when they start. I have bought for them mobile phones. We are connecting me or their mother. It's not only my case. This is an example. Mm-hmm. Until they come back home, every family is concerned so much that these children would come back home. But we are not stopping. Life should go on in Baghdad. Exactly the same thing. Hundreds of thousands of people are back to their offices, exactly as we are functioning in the museum. Yes, sometimes my staff would come to me running. The girls would say, "It's severe shooting in the Haifa Street. What should we do? I say, just, I always say, close up. We close the museum and go home immediately. So this is what we do, but we are back the next morning. So this is the life that's going on in Baghdad. The markets are open. Incidents would happen here and there, but normal life is actually forcing that should come to normal.
Is this, in your view, a determination to try to keep things as normal as possible? Is there in that some defiance of either the insurgents or the Americans or whoever is seen to be disrupting life in Iraq now? This, I mean, the idea that you could keep your children at home, but you don't. You send them out. Is that...
That's right.
Is that an act of defiance in a way?
It is an act of defiance, yeah, because we want the life to go on. We can't stop if some insurgents would kill one or two here or there. This will not stop the life in Baghdad or in Iraq. We are determined to go on with our life, to go on to better life in the country, to go on for democracy and freedom for everybody. What has happened in the country is a major thing, and we have to keep it. We have to protect it by ourselves, our lives. We are losing people, yes, but we believe 100% that the final end, these insurgents will just finish and go away, and normal life will come to Iraq, and the bright sun will shine again, for sure.
Will you vote in the election?
Yes, I will.
That's important?
It is important. It's the right of everybody to vote, and we are determined to exercise that right. Everybody is doing that. Although some danger will happen, and we believe that there might be some attacks to these poll centers, but it is something we will have to do it.
I mean, there was a report out earlier this week, one of the American generals saying that Anbar province and Baghdad and two other provinces, he said, you know what? We can't guarantee anybody's safety. We can't say that people will be able to vote and they won't be blown up. That's four of the 18 provinces that are basically being, you know, you're on your own for this vote. Do you think that the vote will take, that elections will take place there regardless of that? I guess what I'm asking you is a little bit about the determination of people in those areas to vote. Perhaps Fallujah and Ramadi are a little more questionable, but Baghdad, for example.
Let me tell you something, my personal point of view on this. First, we would love to have the elections in time, so much. But since this kind of insurgence and these accidents are happening, a lot of people would love to postpone it for at least something like 6 months. Why? Because we believe 100% that the actions that are taken by the Iraqi National Guards, by the Iraqi police, by the multinational forces, they are going very well. Exactly after what they did in Fallujah and what they are doing now in the Latifiya area, this area to the west side of Baghdad, they are moving on very, very good. So you can see that you can feel it. After Fallujah, it's different. It's not that much threatening the people. So
a few more weeks, a few more months of giving the Iraqi National Guard and the police and the soldiers a chance to establish some confidence.
Exactly. This is what I'm personally thinking. And then we will not have that much danger on Pol Center in Baghdad or in other places.
We are just 3 weeks away from that day when Iraqis will be going to the polls, assuming that the election at the end of this month goes ahead. Donnie George is with me. He is Director General of Iraq's Museum, here to talk about his work guarding the antiquities of the country, but also to talk about what it's like living in Baghdad. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Your chance to speak straight to someone who is there rather than listening to what the media has to say about what's going on there. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. With me in the studio, one of Iraq's most senior archaeologists, Donnie George. He is now Director General of Iraq's museums. And if you'd like to find out a little bit more about the items that we're talking about on the program today, check our website. We're at theconnection.org. We have links to the University of Chicago, the Baghdad Museum, UNESCO, the State Department, all things that are either still missing or have just come back. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Donnie's agreed to join us, not just to talk about what's missing and what's being recovered, but also a little bit about what it's like living in Baghdad today and the perspective from inside that war zone, if we can call it that. I suppose that's a reasonable way of referring to it. That's to the shooting that you describe on Haifa Street. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is that going back to some of my very early visits to Iraq and the first time that we met back in the days when Saddam Hussein was still in charge of the country, there were even at that time dozens, hundreds of archaeologists from around the world who were looking for opportunities to take parts in digs in various parts of the country. Has any of that resumed at all? Are any of the universities and institutes that were so involved with you trying to get back into Iraq to resume that work?
Well, yes, all of our friends and colleagues are trying to. But their countries are not allowing them because of the security situation in the country.
And is that good advice? Should they be kept away for the time being?
Yes, yes. We don't want them because when they come, they go to their remote sites and it's not that safe enough in these sites. But when you mention these expeditions, it means they range from Japan mm-hmm. to the United States, Europe, everywhere in the world we have expeditions coming, universities and academies coming and working, because the antiquities law of Iraq allows non-Iraqi archaeologists, specialists to come and dig. And in a wider perspective that this is actually the heritage of mankind there. So everybody should have a chance to participate in discovering this heritage there. But it's not a good time for them to come. This has not stopped them from working with us. We are working with them now in the way of following the antiquities. They are helping their governments and customs to identify Iraqi antiquities that are captured here and there in the customs or in the airports. They are helping us also in providing us with books that we have missed for about 20 years. We never had fresh books coming, mm-hmm. and fresh publications. So, for instance, books are piled now in the British Museum and they will be sent to Baghdad to our library. And I know books are piled in the Oriental Institute in Chicago from the American institutions. And the first consignment has gone, actually, and it might be now in the museum because it was sent to the American embassy there. And one day before I came, I had a telephone call. So they said, a few days, and we'll bring it to the museum. So they are helping us there. We are working together, but not in the field, of course. But
it's interesting listening to what you're saying, because I hadn't actually thought of this. Once the fighting dies down, once you get back to being a full-time archaeologist rather than a museum guard and archaeologist at the same time, you may be able to do a lot more than you were able to do before, because the directions that came from the Ba'ath Party government came with, they were a little twisted, they were a little
That's
warped,
right.
They had different priorities.
That's right. They were, the thing was, whatever we should do was to serve the aims of Saddam Hussein himself. But now the idea is different. We have to go for science. We have to go and find the linkage between cultures here and there. We have to go and dig for sites that we want to dig as archaeologists, not just like workers that Saddam Hussein wanted us to dig and to say what he wanted to say.
So the anticipation of what lies ahead once the shooting dies down, that's pretty exciting times.
Yeah.
Let's go to Hilton Head, South Carolina, and Selene is joining us on the phone from there. Selene, thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. I wanted to first of all thank the gentleman for the work that he's doing. It's very important, and there are many Americans who support it. I want to just say that. Number two, I want to know if the gentleman is angry at Bush and Company's incompetence and bungling of this entire venture.
You mean specifically in allowing the museum to be looted, Salane, or do you mean in the way the entire occupation has taken place?
The way the entire occupation. It's almost like everything they touch turns to you-know-what.
Well, I tell you one thing, Salane. We are happy. I would say all the Iraqi people are happy because the United States helped us to get rid of Saddam Hussein. But it seems that they did not know how to run the country afterwards, you see. And this is why all these troubles are happening. We believed, you know, just dismantling the Iraqi army immediately or the Iraqi police was something that they should have not done. Now they are starting again the Iraqi army. Now they are starting the Iraqi police because at that time, if they would have kept the army and just pick up the bad, I would say the bad ones from the army and then use the army as it was, that I believe, and a lot of Iraqis believe, it would not have come to this stage.
Let me take Salane's question one step further, though, and ask if in conversations that you have with colleagues, is there a fear that maybe the better times aren't ahead, that having broken apart the power structure that was there without a really clear idea of how to put a new one in place, that it's going to become a state that is run more by religions, that the Sunnis are not going to be able to vote in the elections, that the Shiite will take some higher priorities and maybe place Islam as a more important issue in terms of designing the constitution. Are there fears that you or your colleagues have that it might not work out in the months ahead?
Well, there are fears of all these things, yes. But we believe now, everybody believes that, yes, we have a government now. We started having an army and police. And we are, everybody is believing that it should be a religious government. Mm-hmm. Although a lot of pressure is coming sometimes outside of the country. But everybody is believing it should not become a religious. Well, Islam is a priority there, yes, but Christians are also there, and the other people are also there, the Mindais or the others. This will not stop anyone from practicing his own religion. But everybody know that this bad experience of having religious people ruling a country in our neighborhood is a bad experience. So even in Iraq, a lot of people believe that it's not the right time. I mean, it's not right to have fundamentalist religious people ruling the country. So now everybody is looking for normal government in the country.
Yeah. 1-800-423-8255 is that number to join my conversation this hour with Donnie George. He's Director General of Iraq's Museums, and he lives day by day in Baghdad. Nashville, Tennessee, for our next call. Sam's joining us. Hi, Sam.
Oh, it's actually Tim.
Tim, hi there.
Hi, how are you? Sir, first of all, I just want to thank the gentleman for his bravery, for saving these artifacts, not only for the Iraqi people, but for mankind as well. But my question is this. I wanted to know if he felt like he had the support of the religious leaders in Iraq to not only save these artifacts, but to continue the research. And what brings me to this question is, I know the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda desecrated or actually destroyed the Buddhist statue in Afghanistan. And I just wanted to know if...
Bamiyan statues in northern Afghanistan.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I'm sure that some of these artifacts are probably ancient gods. That I think the Islamic faith would find, or at least some folks in with the Islamic faith would find objectionable. And I'll take the response off the air, and thank you for the excellent program.
Thank you for your call, Tim.
Thank you, Tim. You're right. Everybody is afraid of something like that might happen. But my own experience in this field says not. It will not happen in Iraq because... I can give you an example. When the first days of the looting of the museum, we asked the people in the mosques surrounding the museum to ask the neighborhood to bring back objects, and they did. And the mosques in the area started, they were the first people to bring objects back to the museum. So I don't think that might happen in Iraq. They are not that much fundamentalists like the Taliban people. We do have very brilliant people, and Muslims and Christians, which do respect the heritage of the country. So I don't believe that will happen in Baghdad or in Iraq for the coming time. Although we don't have a religious government till now, it's a fairly good and different kind of government. Yeah.
I'm curious about something. You mentioned earlier in the program that you have now trained up about 1,000 police who are working specifically to help you guard antiquities in Iraq. And yet when we open our morning newspapers here in America, it's always about the attacks that take place on the police, the 20 recruits who were killed in Hilla earlier this week. But it's always the young Iraqis who are joining the National Guard and organizations like the Antiquities Police who are being targeted. I'm curious to know why they do it. What is it that they are so desperate for the money that they'll take that kind of dangerous job because they know that you'll pay them? Is there something else behind that?
I tell you, it's both. First, they are not just normal people coming. Most of them are ex-police or ex-army people. So they are trained, and they are looking for a job. And, of course, we give them lectures and explaining what they are guarding. So we have seen in their faces a good commitment to protect these sites. So it's both, really. It's that they love to protect these sites, and they are having a job. This is a good thing. Yeah.
Where are we going next? To Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bernadette's on the line. Hi, Bernadette. Thanks for calling.
Oh, yes. Hello. I would like to comment that at a time at which universities are making cutbacks, it's absolutely crucial that we not cut back the study of the ancient Iraqi culture, of ancient Assyriology, of the archaeology of the region, of ancient Akkadian literature, ancient Sumerian literature, which is the earliest literature that we have in the entire world.
Bernadette, I'm wondering if when you're talking about that as a priority, though, you see that as something that the Iraqis need to concentrate on, or perhaps an area where a lot of the academic institutions could do more to support this kind of study and preservation that Dr. George is involved with.
Yes, I'm speaking of American and of Western universities, so that he will have colleagues, so that there would be a broader understanding in the military and among politicians of the significance of this culture for world culture. You know, we stood by with horror as the museum was looted, and in addition, as the museum with the Arabic manuscripts was burned, mm-hmm. and there just wasn't a broad and deep enough knowledge of that in this country. I remember when I studied in Germany some years ago that people in Heidelberg remembered very well that someone in the American military knew about the cultural significance of Heidelberg and did not bomb it. We need to have that kind of knowledge for other regions of the world.
I know that there were some attempts made, Bernadette. The symbol for International Heritage Site was painted in large, I think, not on the museum?
All the places, all the museums, all the archaeological institutions, yes, we had. But thank you very much, Bernadette, for your remarks. But I would love to remind... yes, I heard of these cuttings that are happening, but on the other side, there are some other things that are happening. Here in the United States, the USAID has given a lot of money for Stony Brook University to do a lot of programs in Iraq. They have an arrangement with the Department of Antiquities, Department of Archaeology, University of Baghdad, Department of Archaeology, University of Mosul, and the Department of Ancient Languages in the University of Mosul. And they are doing a lot of workshops, rehabilitation to these universities, and also sometimes even with the Iraq Museum. This is something that was very new to us, and it's going on. Professor Elizabeth Stone from the Stony Brook is leading that program, which is actually paid by the United States government. And yes, we would love to continue to have more support from other universities, and we would love them to have some more support from the government for this field, because, as you mentioned, it's not only the Iraqis' Iraqis' heritage there, but it's the mankind heritage.
And I wonder whether or not, as an archaeologist and therefore a student of history, you look at the threat that has existed, continues to exist to the antiquities in Iraq, and see that as some kind of moment when, in fact, more than just archaeologists began to pay attention to the importance of this. I wonder if you think something has changed in the way people regard the importance of these artifacts.
Yes, a lot has been changed in the whole world, and even in the country, even in Iraq. You see, I mentioned several times every Iraqi was touched in his heart for it happened to the Iraq Museum. Now, everybody, we did have some problems before that not much Iraqis come to the Iraq Museum. Now, everybody is, whenever they know that I'm connected with the museum, everybody is asking when the museum will be open. We want to come and see it. We want to see what's back. We want to see what had happened in the history. So it was a very touchy moment all the time to have this information spread to the Iraqi people first and to all over the world.
So what's your idea? When will those doors open?
Well, it depends. You know, we guard these doors and this institution by our hearts and our eyes. And whenever it's safe enough, we may open the doors and everybody can come, not only to the museum, but even the archaeologists can come and participate in discovering that wonderful history and cultural heritage that we have there.
Well, it'll be a great day for you and the archaeologists, but I think, as you describe, also for the people of Iraq and the rest of us as well. I want to thank you for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Donnie George is Director General of Iraq's Museums, and as I mentioned, links to some of the items that have been recovered or are still missing at our website. You can find us at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.